Well, and welcome to this week's reading from GQ. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Luke Sartori. Reading from GQ.com this week, starting in the sports section. I don't think you can keep chasing the dragon. Christian Yelich on becoming a vet, playing with Ichiro, and baseball's supposed juice ball era. For a stretch in 2018, the Milwaukee Brewers left fielder was arguably the best player on earth. 6 years later, with an influx of Gen Z teammates reminding him of his sporting mortality, Yelich is living in the present. By Matthew Roberson. Articles from April 18, 2024. It's late March in New York, and today the Milwaukee Brewers are supposed to open their season against the Mets, but the city's battered by rain, so the Brewers are instead cooped in their Midtown Manhattan hotel, rained out and shut in. Christian Yelich, the former MVP and longtime face of the Brewers franchise, has no problem with waiting. This is his way. Chilling for an extra 24 hours is a little easier for Yelich than it is for some of his less seasoned, extra-eager teammates. Especially Chorio, who was a teenager 2 weeks ago, Yelich laughs, referring to Jackson Chourio, the 20-year-old phenom he now shares the outfield with. At 32 years young, Yelich is now the oldest position player on the Brewers roster, which is really crazy because I don't feel like one of the older guys, he says. I guess I still feel like I mix it up pretty well with the young guys. They're all really talented players, but very, very, very young, he adds. Each very communicating respect to his teammates born in the 2000s while also emphasizing surprise at his newfound veteran status. If Yelich comes off as younger than his years, it's in part because he is. In so many ways, built from the classic Southern California ballplayer mold. Growing up in Thousand Oaks turned his laid-back levels up to a million, and as we chat in one of the hotel's spacious conference rooms, his voice rarely goes up or down. Mirroring the calm he exudes in the batter's box, he wears a plain-colored hoodie and a pair of understated Nikes. Stealth wealth, but make it baseball. And nurses a cup of coffee from the team's breakfast spread. He's got the tall and wiry build typical of long-ago ballplayers, but his clean-shaven, angular face has drawn comparisons to Pete Davidson for nearly a decade now. Every night, somebody will scream it from the stands, he says. Or somebody will come up on the street and they think it's the first time I've ever heard it. Thanks, man. At this stage of his career and his life, Yelich occupies a space fairly unique to athletes. He's the oldest hitter on the team, but he's not old at all in real life. He's still really good, but he's not quite at the level that won him an MVP. He's closer to the end of his playing days than he is the beginning, but whenever that ending comes, and it may not come for a while, he'll still have a whole life to lead. That's part of the reason why, he tells me, he's embraced social media more than most of his quiet, some would say boring, MLB contemporaries. His willingness to put himself out there comes from knowing that time spent as a professional baseball player is very finite, and thinking it is cool to document some of this stuff. This is partially why he enlisted the help of Tom Brady's crack social media team to give his Instagram some of the same flavor. Cribbing young and modern ideas from an older lionized figure is kind of perfectly symbolic. Thanks to fortuitous timing, Yelich can be seen as a bridge between different eras of baseball and the way our feelings and opinions about the game have changed over time. Yelich was a 2010 first-round pick by the Florida Marlins, before the Miami rebrand, and debuted as a 21-year-old in 2013. Some teammates from his first 2 years with the Marlins, we're talking dudes like Juan Pierre, Placido Polanco, and Rafael Furcal, are straight out of the Remember Some Guys catalog. He's played with Ichiro, born in 1973, and now with Chourio, born in 2004. Apart from winning it all, he's seen mostly everything the game can throw at a guy. Literally and figuratively. I've been on teams where we haven't been good, he says. I've been on teams where the general manager became the actual manager. I've been on teams where, unfortunately, a teammate passed away in the middle of the season. I've been traded, been on playoff teams, I've had good years, I've had years that were tougher. I think the longer that you play, you kind of get to experience all this stuff and you draw from all those experiences. Hey, I know shit seems good or I know shit seems bad right now, but just stay the course. Who knows what it's going to look like in September? It's obvious that the tumult he's referring to here is the end of his run with the Marlins. There wasn't a lot of winning in those years, or during any part of his tenure with the Fish, for that matter. Even though Yelich was slowly turning into one of the best young players in the league and played with young stars like the late Jose Fernandez, Giancarlo Stanton, JT Romualdo, and Nathan Eovaldi, tragedy struck in 2016 when Fernandez, just 24, died in a boating accident during the season. In many ways, that era of Marlins baseball died with him. The team traded Yelich and the rest of the young core in the following years, leaving them with very little to show for a period that began with so much promise. Even amid a concerted youth movement, Yelich spent time with a couple of goats. Barry Bonds was briefly the team's hitting coach, which came with its own challenges. What works for the greatest hitter of all time doesn't exactly work for everyone. Picking his brain helped me tremendously, Yelich shares. But there were definitely some times where it was like, yes, I get it, but also you're Barry Bonds. And Yelich says the most nervous he's ever been was when the Marlins were in Colorado, where his then teammate Ichiro recorded his 3,000th hit. Yelich estimates 150 members of the Japanese media had been following them around for weeks, waiting for their compatriot to reach the historical milestone. He finally gets it. We go out on the field and we're playing catch in between innings. I remember being like, don't throw the fucking ball over his head right now. Don't fuck this up. Thankfully, I didn't do that, which was cool. Along with being a bridge to a litany of revered retired guys, Yelich is one of a bridge from style of baseball to another. In the late 2010s, he became one of the poster children for an analytical trend that had taken the game by storm. Call it the launch angle revolution. Elevate and celebrate. Whatever. Just know the basic tenets are that if you hit the ball in the air, you will do much more damage. During the 2018 season, his first with the Brew Crew, Yelich went from a nice foundational piece to a bona fide superstar. There, and somewhat remarkably, he overhauled his entire offensive approach on the fly, turning from a ground ball machine. In fact, when he was a Marlin, literally nobody in the league hit the ball on the ground more often than him, to one of the league's most feared power threats. His batting average shot up and so did his power numbers. He finished the 2018 campaign with 36 home runs, 15 more than his career high. Yelich says it all began with an opposite field dinger. He smacked in the 2018 All-Star game. I came back in the second half and started messing around with some stuff in the cage, just honestly getting loose that day. I told our hitting coach, hey, don't freak out. I'm just messing around for these 15 swings. I wonder what will happen. Something happened. It was like, oh, wow, this feels really good. I'm going to keep doing it. What do I have to lose? I might as well fuck around with this and see what happens. I got really locked in and kept tinkering with it throughout that year and into the off season. It was something really little and just kind of became what it became. And it all started on the first day back from the All-Star break. The change, along with the success it brought, helped Yelich become an almost divine figure in Wisconsin. When Yelich was traded there in 2018, the Brewers had fallen on hard times, missing the playoffs for 6 years straight. The new guy's impact was immediate and sustained. That year, he led the team to the brink of the World Series, and the Brewers returned to the postseason each of the next 3 years as well, giving Milwaukee its best four-year run in the team's entire history. That made Yelich one of the golden boys of the upper Midwest, a title not without its perks. It's a great sports town. Summer in Milwaukee is pretty cool, he insists. People tailgate the games. It's really cool to be part of. I wasn't familiar with Milwaukee until I got traded there. One place that ride has taken him is to a new tax bracket. Every professional athlete these days does well at the bank, to be clear, but very few have ever signed a contract like the one Yelich did in 2020. On March 6th of that faithful year, the Brewers inked Yelich to a 9-year, $215 million contract extension. Just a handful of days later, the world shut down, leaving the new mega-rich outfielder in a bit of an odd place. "I think that's your goal forever," he says of getting the nine-figure bag. "But how many guys does this ever really happen to? Signing a big deal is so rare, and then to finally have that in front of you, for me, was a surreal experience. It was such a cool moment, and then a week later you're like, what the fuck happened? We're going home?" When the abbreviated 2020 season finally got off the ground, Yelich struggled for the first time. He went from hitting .327 over the previous two seasons all the way down to an unrecognizable .205 in 2020. And even when things returned to normal in 2021, he experienced back troubles that kept him off the field for a chunk of the season and zapped his power. 2022 brought more regression, as he led the league in ground ball percentage again and finished with just 14 home runs, causing some to say that his home run barrage had been a fluke. It wasn't until 2023 that he started to straighten out again, but his statistical decline also coincided with growing rumors and eventually revelations that MLB had been using a different, seemingly rocket-fueled ball during his heyday. Yelich detractors now had scientific evidence that his best power year was the result of playing the game on a slightly easier mode. When I asked if being labeled a juice ball benefactor bothers him, though, he is a California chill about it all. "Yeah, but people are always going to have an opinion on everything, and everybody was playing with the same stuff. If they're saying 19 was the juice ball year, if you look back on all those home runs, I think I only had a couple where I'm like, I don't know if that should have been a homer. There's maybe three or four where I'm like, eh." Despite a recent back injury, his 2024 is off to a roaring start, the type to invent the "we're so back" conversations. But whether or not he ever gets back to the Christian Yelich of old, I get the sense that he's at peace no matter what. I ask if he ever compares himself to himself, the MVP version. And he explains that that's not really his thing. "I mean, look, they were great years and it was great experience in them, but I don't think you can keep chasing the dragon," he says. "Each year has to be its own thing. How you move, how your body moves, how the game is. It's different than it was 6 years ago. So you don't want to watch stuff from that year and try to copy it. My whole thing is to just be the best version of you this year, whatever that is." Moving along to the culture section of GQ.com this week. This article was published April 10th, 2024. Marcus King talks about writing with Rick Rubin and stripping it down to the copper. How the one-time blues rock prodigy revamped his process, got his mind right, and made an album about finding hope in hopelessness. By Will Shuby. Marcus King has been through it. His new album, Mood Swings, opens with the title track, which begins with a sample that goes like this. And I think that is the part of all that a person in depression really tastes. The hopelessness, the terrible hopelessness. Then terrible hopelessness loops into infinity, threatening to cave in and suffocate the song before it even begins. Mood Swings turns into a swinging soul pop number, but that sample is a brutal way to start an album. And an intriguing stylistic shift from an artist who's been a modern-day blues rock god up until now. Mood Swings' edges are softer than on earlier albums like 2020's El Dorado and 2018's Carolina Confessions. The admission's more guilt-ridden than defiant. Marcus King is working on being alive and things are getting better, but every slip-up hits like a knife in the gut. On the aforementioned title track, King begins, "Let's take another one. I swear I'm having fun, but I look miserable. Cause time don't heal no pain. I still just feel the same, cause time is standing still." The chorus is a miracle, or a reflection on the work King has been putting in, to move away from the indulgences of rock and roll lifestyle and something more toward the peaceful repetition of domestic bliss. "Feel like I can really be myself around you," he sings. King is married now. More on that in a bit. Maybe things are getting better. According to King, they are. The clouds cleared all at once. When he thought summer had arrived, thunder came rolling through and depression set back in. But he also found the tools to work through it, very slowly and then all at once. Marcus got married in 2023. They just met when he started work on Mood Swings, back when he was tracking demos with Rick Rubin at his Shangri-La Retreat Kung studio in Malibu. He hadn't seen his new fling in a while, so he flew her out to LA, real rock star shit. She was a VP at Bank of America. Her life was together. The rock and roll lifestyle looked far less glamorous when she would take care of him after long nights or a bit of excess. Rubin's devotion to mindfulness and mental health didn't work as well when King would drink. So like so many who spend time in LA, he made a concerted effort to get better. The album tells the story of this journey, a struggle he still deals with every day. As he tells GQ, "I may get off the phone and feel the depths of hell that I've felt before, but I just have to stay confident that it'll pass." GQ: "I know y'all are touring with Chris Stapleton. What's something you've learned from him over the years?" "I really love the subtle approach that Chris takes on his show. He allows his abilities as a writer and a singer and a guitar player to shine through without any smoke and without any mirrors. I really admire the quality of putting on a stadium show without the use of all those tricks of the trade. Some people rely solely on that, whereas he doesn't use them at all, and his voice can carry that stadium. It's really impactful to see as a young artist." "You've always had a certain vulnerability that you're able to tap into, but you get pretty open and pretty raw on this record. Did that take some growing into on your part?" "It took a little trial and error, and once we got there, I realized what Rick Rubin was pushing me towards in the writing process for this album. It was a year of just writing and tracking demos at Shangri-La. None of them were really sticking, and I was getting a little discouraged. Once I kind of ripped all the metaphors away and just started speaking directly, and without the use of the metaphor, any hyperbole or whatever, it was just raw and true." Rick's favorite demo was Bipolar Love, and his idea on the record was to allow this modern component to an otherwise throwback sound. "I don't like that phrase or that term, but I think it's befitting that because everything on the record uses technology that you would have had access to in the 60s, but you would have also had access to it today, obviously. I think throwback is the same as timeless anyways. I say that to say his idea was to allow the lyrical content to be the modern component that we paired with this timeless or throwback sound, and he was right with that. Working with someone like Rick is amazing. But were you able to honor your own voice in a collaborative way, or were you deferring to him?" "Oh man, it was all my voice. That's all his production style really is. He makes you go so deep within yourself that you never realize that those parts were there. It was just really healing in a mindful way and a therapeutic way to write these songs. I also went to talk therapy and utilized all those other strategies to improve my mental health. It was all happening at the right time." "Press release for this record that you thought you might not be here if these songs didn't exist. Are you comfortable talking about some of the struggles you've gone through over the past few years?" "Absolutely. It's easier for me to talk about that now, and I've been able to separate myself from it. And I look at it more as an opportunity to advise others against that and just as an opportunity to advocate for creativity over loss of life. Obviously, but creativity over that dark place too. It's a writing partner, and whenever that comes around, I know it's time to get to work. And the dark thoughts usually leave after I write through it." "Substance-wise, were you dabbling in drugs or drinking? What was your vice?" "The amount that we work and the amount that we try to emote and the amount of ourselves that we leave on stage every night because that's the only way we know how to do it is intense. I leave it all out there because otherwise I feel like I did a disservice to the audience. If I don't walk away feeling like I left something up there, that can be really depleting if you're not doing supplemental routine and a workout routine. Now everything is pretty extensive, just to try to keep myself healthy and have some drive left over. I used to try to supplement in other ways and try to play as hard as I worked, and it's just detrimental at the end of the day. There are certain things that can be done in moderation. I just lack the ability to do so." You can maybe go some time without drinking or doing drugs, but once you start doing them, it's kind of hard to stop. Is that how you would describe it? That's a fair way to describe it. It's kind of a binge mentality, but I approach everything in my life like that. That's why I know alcohol is just, and drugs for that matter, not great. It depends on the drugs. I'm obviously on a campaign right now. I just released a strain of marijuana, and I think that's really great, and I'm really thrilled about that. Let me try to rephrase this. I guess everything I do in my life is similar to intermittent fasting. I get to eat what I want, but I only do it within a small window. If I were ever to think about having a drink again, it would be under these really strict windows of time, the same way that I approach my diet. But for right now, I'm okay without it. I'm just sticking with my pot. I know you're married. Did finding someone who cares about you almost more than you do kick you into gear in a way? That was a really big push that I needed. All these things happened right as they were supposed to. Meeting my wife the second night out on tour, I decided I was going to do all the things. I loved in excess, and I got to play music too, which to me, I thought was a pretty good exit strategy. My extracurriculars started to affect my real love, which was music. I wasn't able to put my best show on that I could, which really hurt me. But I met her the second night out, which was thrilling. She had a really good job, and she definitely didn't need me, and I could see that she saw what a fuck-up I was, and I think she felt a little bit of a need to protect me and to help me rescue me from myself in a lot of ways. Between her being nurturing and also having light shined on me because of how together she was and how much I was not, it was really a push in the right direction. You're not necessarily feeling that things you sing out on the album. Some of the songs are old. You have to reconcile something and get back to that place in a way? Well, man, it's a day-to-day thing. It's almost like depression is something I feel I'm always in remission of because it's an imbalanced thing, and it's really threatening trying to walk the line. I never know from day to day. I might get off the phone and feel the depths of hell that I felt before, but I just have to stay confident that it'll pass. Playing music and being able to do it, I feel like I bank a lot of dopamine. And when I need to tap into that, that extra resource is there. You put in the work and you have to trust that the work is doing its job. That's why they call it exercise, because I just got out of the gym and I got to do that all the time. Now I got to go do some mindfulness exercises. It's something that you have to do every day and it is rare. There are people I know who don't have to exercise in the gym and they eat whatever they want to. But I just know that I'm neither one of those people, so I have to exercise both of them. You really expanded a new sonic territory on this album. Was that something you decided early on? Was it a decision made with Rick, or something else entirely? I think after Rick and my first meeting, we started putting together which demos we wanted to go after first. The two musicians he brought in, the only way I could put it is that they were born to do what they do. It's like something that's innate in them. It's effortless. It kind of just flows out of them. I played with Chris Dave on drums and Corey Henry on organ and myself. That was really moving to be in a room with those guys. When we first started recording, it was also my wife and my third date. I flew her to LA because I'd only taken her on a date or two and I wanted to see her. I was going to be out there a while, so I flew her out and she spent time with me. It was just the inspiration around me at every turn. It was hard not to be inspired. Those two guys, just what you hear on the record, is just what kind of flowed out and what they felt inspired to play based off of the raw demos of songs that I had. They just kind of grew from there. As far as the sound of the record, there's a sparseness to it that I love, and that I could only compare to Rick's interior design capabilities. If you look up the way that Rick designed the inside of his home or the inside of Shangri-La, it's all based off of minimalism, and it's based off of attracting the eye to the natural and attracting the eye to what Mother Nature is providing you, instead of trying to fabricate it within this environment. That's a similar approach we took to this as far as we stripped everything away during the mixing process, and we sit and listen, and we wanted the music to stand almost on its own. Just like the essence of a song. We wanted the work to be able to stand alone without the support of bass or without the structure of drums and without the garnish of keys or guitar and all that stuff we did after the fact. Is it mostly Chris and Corey on the final version of the album? Yeah, the majority of it, with the exception of three songs. One of the original concepts was for me and Corey and Chris to play general ideas of the songs that I'd written and then to sample ourselves. I guess that's a studio trick. Rick was borrowing from the hip-hop side of his brain, but we ended up not doing that as much as we planned. Delilah is a first take. What was it like being in Italy with him? It was really incredible. We just spent a few hours every day unpacking the material, listening to it, and stripping it down to the copper, and trying to see the essence of the song. We were just trying to make them stand on their own. We would do that every day, but in the practice, we would try to do different vocal approaches. To my understanding, it's the most intimately Rick's been involved in a project in some time, and that means a great deal to me. We even did things such as listening to Chris Cornell vocals that he had done to reference the way that Chris would approach some things vocally. It helped me get out of a box that I might have been stuck in. We were inspired to listen to records from some gospel services that Rick had attended. I had spent some time to find samples, and the opening of the record is a good example of that. I spent a long time trying to find intake patient interviews, because the epiphany I had was that I'm a mental patient because I go to a psychiatrist and they prescribe me medication. So in the broad scheme of things, I'm a mental patient, I think a lot of us are, but I wanted to find a clip that reflected this. When I did, it really resonated with me. I bet it made you want to continue as an advocate. I want people to come and have a good time at my shows. That's what it's all about. It's about a release. I just want people to come, and I want to see all sorts of folks out having a good time, however they feel comfortable having a good time. I'm not preaching anything to anybody. I just want you to come out and listen. I try to be mindful of the idea because I have a lot of evangelicals in my family, and I grew up in church. I'm thankful for that structure I had growing up, but a lot of people are really turned off by people trying to preach their philosophies at you. It makes them feel so good. Why wouldn't they want to share it? I try to be mindful of that too, though this feels a little bit more widely accepted than some other things. So come on out and hear the gospel. By Will Shuby. That's all the time we have for today, folks. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Luke Sartori, reading from GQ.com. Remember, this program can also be found on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.